Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Haruska, Senior Advisor for Communications and Strategy at ACS. Today is a double feature as we detail two developments with the potential to impact our fundamental freedoms. First, I'll speak with Lindsay Langholz, ACS Senior Director of Policy and Program, about an unusual August election in Ohio and why it could be decisive for abortion rights in the state. And then I'll speak with Russ Feingold, ACS president, about the fact that President Biden has fallen behind his predecessor's pace in judicial confirmations. And we will look ahead to what that could mean for Biden's ability to fill dozens of federal court vacancies by the end of his first term. Lindsay, welcome back to Broken Law.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
It's fun to have you on this side of the table.
It's always nice to be on this side. It's easier on this side.
So we're going to start talking about abortion rights, and then it's going to get into some odd technicalities. But we're speaking a little over a year since Dobbs happened, since Roe v. Wade was overturned. And in response to that, we've seen voters in a handful of states turn to ballot initiatives. What are ballot initiatives and why have they been so relevant post-Dobbs?
It's a great question. Ballot initiatives are a tool of direct democracy. So it's a way for voters to directly weigh in on particular issues, as opposed to voting for a candidate who may support the things that you like. This is a way that voters are able to make their voice heard specifically on one topic or a series of topics, depending on how it's constructed. It's set up differently state to state. So some states don't even have ballot initiative opportunities. Some have very active ballot initiative processes. And you might think of like California, where it feels like there's always amendments to the Constitution on the ballot in California. And it really varies state to state. It's one of the, some would say, great things about having elections administered differently by each state is that it really gives voters an opportunity to find a system that works for them.
So Ohio has an election coming up in November. Yep. And as of right now, we are recording this on August 1st.
In the morning, we should say.
In the morning. At 10:45 a.m. on August 1st, 2023. There's a ballot initiative scheduled for the November election in Ohio.
Yes.
What is that ballot initiative?
That ballot initiative deals with abortion. And the reason that it's so relevant is in Ohio, we've got a state legislature that has super majorities of conservatives. And that's in part due to some pretty extreme gerrymandering that has come out of the state. Regular listeners of the podcast will remember we've talked about a number of cases that went back and forth and back and forth in Ohio dealing with their gerrymandered districts. But through a series of events, there's just really extreme imbalance in Ohio compared to when you look at the results of statewide elections and others in Ohio. It's not to say Ohio is a wildly blue state that has very red leadership, but it's pretty split. And you wouldn't know that looking at the state legislature. And so abortion proponents in Ohio have said, listen, we've seen the success that 2022 brought other states. We're going to take this issue directly to voters, and we're going to ask them the question as opposed to leaving it up to our very conservative state legislatures.
So if the ballot initiative were to succeed in November, what would it do?
It would do a couple of things, but most importantly, it would establish a state constitutional right to abortion. Also other things like fertility treatment, miscarriage care, but most importantly, and the reason this is drawing so much attention, is it would establish a state constitutional right to abortion.
Again, as of right now, it's 10:48 a.m. on August 1st.
Yeah.
For a ballot initiative to pass in Ohio, it simply requires majority support.
Yes. As it currently stands, yes. And also, I should note that it has made the ballot for November. So all the signatures have been collected.
Under current requirements.
Yes.
It is on the ballot. It would require only majority support.
Yes, exactly.
All right. So that's November. Oddly enough, Ohio has an election in August. And I don't know about you, Lindsay. I think of many things in August. I think of summer. I think of the beach. I think of vacation. I don't think of election season.
I mean, listen, I do only because I spent a good amount of time in Tennessee. Tennessee has a special place in my heart. Tennessee has a primary election coming up soon, or for cities like Nashville, They have a nonpartisan mayoral. It's coming up in about a week from when we're recording, but that's an established pattern, right? And voters in Tennessee, especially in Nashville, come to expect an election in August every couple of years. Ohio voters do not. I've also spent a lot of time in Ohio. And let me tell you, that is not a time when Ohio voters are tuning in. And we saw that last year. There was a special election because of all that gerrymandered map back and forth and back and forth. They held an election last August. And all of the conservative leaders who are pushing this current election back a year ago were like, this is terrible. We can never have...
Because there was low voter turnout. Shocking.
And the thing is like, that was a remedy for something that had been caused. This is one that they've just decided to throw into the works. And so it's an extraordinary measure, but one entirely of their own making.
Yeah.
And one that really we saw last year... horrible turnout compared to typical cycles, comparable cycles.
Which is why there was an agreement last year of like, let's not do this again.
Yeah.
Let's not have an election in August. Oh, wait, but for this one thing.
And here we are. And so I want to make clear that even if we see good turnout for such an election, for this one, it's truly credit to the organizers who have done an extraordinary job trying to educate folks on this issue because it's complicated, trying to mobilize folks at a time, as you said, that they're not used to dealing with these issues. It's going to be really interesting to see how it turns out, but I would hate for the success of a good turnout to mean like, oh, this is fine. It's not fine either way.
Yeah, so let's get into it. So there is one issue on the ballot, one issue only, and it's called State Issue 1.
Mm-hmm.
What would it do?
So it would change the way, specifically the way that voters can weigh in on constitutional amendments would change. There's a couple different ways that ballot initiatives work in Ohio. You can either respond to a law that's been passed. Citizens can propose a new law. This is only about constitutional amendments. And what it would do is raise the threshold, and it would only impact the way that constitutional amendments are brought by citizens. So right now,
end up on the ballot.
Yes, exactly. So right now, there's two ways for constitutional amendments to end up before voters on the ballot. One is the state legislature can put an issue on the ballot for voters to weigh in on. That's how State Issue 1 ended up on the ballot. The other is for citizen initiative. And so the current standard is that you have to get signatures, a certain number, based on previous gubernatorial elections. We won't get into the math, but you had to have a certain number of signatures from 44 counties, half of Ohio counties. This would change it to 88. And all 88, it may seem reasonable, like, oh, every county.
That's every county in the state.
Yeah, but we're talking about like tiny little Vinton County, right?
Yeah.
It is not only conservative, it is small. It is very small. And so to find voters is so expensive. It is so
expensive. But just more than that, you're changing the standard. Ohio for over 100 years has said 44 counties.
Yep.
And now suddenly they want to say, no, every single county.
And to be clear, it's not as if the standard was super lax anyway. It wasn't as if there were hundreds of constitutional amendments being brought by citizens and put before voters. The vast majority of constitutional amendments that have been voted on were actually initiated by the state legislature. And so this is already...
This is not an abused mechanism by any means. Yeah.
And it is one that, as you mentioned, has worked for over 100 years. It is one that Ohio voters have used to great effect to deal with things like gerrymandered state legislatures that are out of step with their own personal politics and beliefs, and we've seen it used to do things that voters are really passionate about. And this would absolutely change not only the way to get on the ballot, but then, as we've alluded to a few times, it would change the threshold for a successful ballot measure. So
explain that. How so?
So right now, in order to pass, it would need 50% plus one vote. So the thing you think.
Simple majority.
Yeah. Now, how
that's the current standard.
Right. This would raise the threshold to 60% plus one vote. And so what you're looking at is in a state like Ohio, a entrenched minority continuing to double down on their power and say, no, 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 the 40% here are actually more important. And the reason this is so important is an issue like abortion is popular. It is supported by voters in basically every state it's come before so far. But it doesn't necessarily mean that a super majority support any given issue, particularly hot button issues in this country. And 60% is quite a threshold to have to meet for any ballot initiative, yeah, including abortion.
So I want to be clear about what is happening here.
Yeah.
The super gerrymandered GOP legislature put state issue one on the ballot for an August election. It will be subject to the current standard, which is a simple majority vote.
Yes.
So if a simple majority of Ohio voters who turn out in a low turnout August election,
yeah,
approve state issue one, it will immediately ratchet up the threshold for the November election, meaning it could thwart,
yes,
the ballot initiative about abortion rights. And let's be honest, that's the point.
And the in-state proponents, and some of the state proponents, I'm assuming, but I haven't, the in-state proponents have absolutely said, this is about abortion.
Right. They don't want to fight that ballot initiative on the merits. They'd rather change the rules of the game and keep it off the ballot entirely.
Yes. And Ohio voters, by the time you're listening to this, will be like, I've seen so many ads.
Yeah, for our Ohio listeners, we apologize.
Yes.
You can skip ahead to my conversation with Russ. This is really for listeners in every other state.
But, you know, in the ads that we're seeing out of Ohio have done what a number of other states have done, which is kind of muddy the waters a little bit and said, like, this is about parental rights. And this is like, oh, no, your trans kid might seek a care that you didn't approve. And, like, it's all the tricks that we've seen in a number of other states. But when you look at the money that's going in behind the pro state issue one, there's so much money coming from the anti-abortion movement flowing into this election. And even
though it would impact any future ballot initiative on any topic, they are singularly focused on the abortion ballot initiative.
They are for now. I don't think it's coincident. Like, I think that anti-democratic measures are being used by conservatives across the country. And abortion is currently the driver of more progressive politics. And so that's why you're seeing such an intense focus. But it's certainly not out of step with what we've been, yeah, seeing. And we've seen state legislatures.
If you have control of the legislature, you don't want citizens to have this type of power.
Or even divided government, right? We've seen in some, yeah, states where there's maybe a more progressive governor and a more conservative state legislature, we've seen kind of a stripping of powers and a hobbling of their agenda. And so, yes, this is definitely about abortion. I think that it is not only about abortion in the sense that it is at its heart about control.
Minority control.
Minority control. And we're in Ohio, it's a little unclear, but it's definitely about making sure that there is an entrenchment of power that already exists.
Yeah. So the election will be happening the day that this episode comes out. So listeners may already know the results.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to ask you to speculate about how the election is going to turn out. But I just want you to elaborate on that, because we're talking about Ohio, but this really has ramifications across the country, because what we have seen is when a tactic works in one state, the right will readily pick it up and use it in other states. And so I don't think Ohio conservatives are the only one looking at the ballot initiative process and saying, we gotta change this. This can't be used against us.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, so as someone who's worked in Ohio before in the political space, I can say that what starts in Ohio often doesn't end in Ohio. It's not unusual for things to get tested in that state. Voter purges and all sorts of other anti-democratic measures. And I think that the anti-abortion folks saw the wave of success that happened in 2022, yep, and realized,
including in states like Kansas,
yep, Montana, you know, across the board, Kentucky, it was across the board. And so I think that you're really going to see what would generously be described as some creative problem solving on the other end. But what I think that we are calling out specifically is anti-democratic, especially when you look at the decision in Dobbs. I don't like to look at the majority opinion and say, like, I'm going to take it at its word because it's so flawed in so many ways. But in theory, Dobbs is returning this issue to the voters. That was how it was all packaged and told to us, that it's fine.
And what's more returning it to the voters than a ballot initiative where it's literally the voters deciding?
And so it is showing the lie. I think that what's happening in Ohio is showing the lie that this is absolutely not being put in the hands of voters in a direct way. They want it to be filtered through institutions that they already control and can maintain that control through a series of anti-democratic measures. And so, you know, we like to draw the link often between abortion and democracy issues. And I think this is a really great example of why they're so interconnected. Yeah.
Well, and the fact that Ohio's maps are gerrymandered is thanks to the Supreme Court, which has okayed partisan gerrymandering. And the conservative justices knew that when they said, oh, we're returning abortion to the voters.
Yeah. And it's complicated in Ohio because Ohio voters then said, okay, then we want to put in our state constitution that we can't do this. And so, like, seeing the constitutional amendment process in Ohio work. With some caveats and with some, you know, asterisks, but it's the way the government is supposed to work its way through is, you know, this kind of grind. And instead, what conservatives in Ohio have done is said, scrap all of that. We're going to have this thing that we said a year ago was a waste of money, was against everything that we hold dear. And we're going to put it in now just to keep abortion from being something that voters actually get to weigh in on.
Yeah. So I want to end with the point that you brought up earlier, which is it's quite possible that we actually see robust turnout during this election. And to be clear, that is not because it was smart to have an election in August. If you actually care about turnout, it will be the result of just massive amounts of door knocking and organizing in the state.
Absolutely. And, you know, it reminds me of the same argument that gets trotted out every time that there are massive voter restrictions put in front of voters. And then when there's, a force
good back, turnout and
in response to those restrictions, then the argument that's posed to us progressives is often
like, oh, that wasn't so restrictive.
Look, it's fine. Look, voters waited an 8-hour lines and, you know, that's the system working somehow. And the reality is that this shouldn't be the way that our system operates. It shouldn't be that you just change the rules of the game to better enable you to have power. And then when it doesn't work, you say, well, look, what are you complaining about in the first place? It's just such a broken system and it's such a nefarious lie. And so I'm hopeful, waiting for the results of the election, and we'll see how it turns out. So far, the polling has been encouraging that we've seen, and we've seen bipartisan support against issue one. I think that a lot of voters in Ohio understand that
they're being played.
Yeah. And one thing we haven't talked about is, you know, it's being packaged as a way to protect Ohio voters from out-of-state money. And then when you look at the
as out-of-state money, he funds state issue one.
Yeah, you look at the out-of-state money and it's one Illinois billionaire who's made it his pet project, who put in $4 million of the $4.8 million that the Yes campaign has taken. And you say, y'all aren't even pretending anymore. Like, I mean, you're putting these like fig leaves up, but it's not even convincing. And so I'm really hoping that Ohio voters kind of see through this cynical ploy.
Well, I'm guessing we're going to be returning to this. We'll certainly be talking about elections come November. We're going to do a lot of coverage heading into next year. So listeners will know the election outcome shortly after this episode drops, and we'll certainly circle back in terms of its impact. And should the ballot initiative stay on the ballot for November, we will certainly be talking about that.
Yes.
So Lindsay, as always, thank you so much for joining on Broken Law.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation. Russ, welcome back to the show.
Always enjoy being on it, Jeannie. Thank you.
It's great to have you back so soon.
Well, we got a lot to deal with in these next few months. It's going to be a hell of a end of this year and next year. So we need to talk about these things.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, to say the least. So I wish we were actually talking at about a happier topic, but we're touching base on judicial confirmations. Before we get into the numbers, I always love to hear you explain, generally, why do courts matter? Why do we spend so much time talking about them?
I mean, I would say a couple of years ago, if I had said courts matter, it would have sounded kind of boring, you know, like the Green Bay Packers matter or something like that. In other words, it's obvious. But I think for most people, that's sort of a given. They assume the courts are on the level and that they're not political and that they're legitimate and that people can rely on them. And that has to be the way it is. The problem is we're in an era right now where that's being called into question, particularly at the level of the United States Supreme Court. So now when you say to people who are concerned about individual rights, reproductive rights, LGBTQ plus rights, voting rights, they look at you like, absolutely, of course courts matter. This is terrible what's happening. So the mantra or the thing that we say all every day at ACS, courts matter, is really resonating now because people are worried and frankly scared at the question of whether the courts are really on the level.
Well, and when we say courts matter, what that also means is judges matter.
That's right. Judges matter, of course, at the Supreme Court level. Everybody knows that. They also matter a great deal at the Court of Appeals level at the federal level because they are often the last word. The court only takes, a modest number of cases. And then individual district court judges who have life terms, as we know, sadly, can really roil the situation and create great problems on their own, as the judge did in Texas with the abortion pill case, where he caused a huge national uproar. One single judge can cause a huge problem. And that's just at the federal level. Judges matter tremendously at the state level. I'm in Wisconsin at the moment, where we have had a terrible politicization of our state Supreme Court by the far right. That's going to change, actually, on the day we're recording this, when a change will occur in the makeup of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But not after a great deal of damage was done to reproductive rights, voting rights, and many other rights. So courts matter across the board.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we were really encouraged about when President Biden took office is he got this. You know, ACS has spent so long trying to get progressives to care as much about the court and to prioritize them as much as the right has for decades. And President Biden really came in saying courts are going to be a priority. The Senate majority came in saying courts are going to be a priority. And for the last 2.5 years, I think they've lived up to that. So avoid talking about what we're immediately going to discuss. Generally speaking, how has President Biden and this Senate been doing on judges?
Well, not only did Joe Biden get this in the past, he continues to get it. I understand that of the things that he has to spend his time on, there are so many. This is something that he devotes a great deal of his time to as president. He really cares about it. And, you know, I was on that Senate Judiciary Committee for 16 years with him, with Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, with Richard Durbin, Dick Durbin, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. They all completely get it. And I know that they sincerely care about this. And they've done very well. They have managed to have 140 lifetime appointments confirmed now as we move into the 2.5 year part of the term of the president's term. And the most astonishing thing about it, that's very good, is that the diversity of these appointments is a record diversity. Donald Trump had something like 70%+ white nominees, and Joe Biden has 67% people of color. Trump had 3/4 male appointees. Biden has 67% women. So it's a complete reversal of the unfortunate failure of the federal judiciary to reflect the people of this country. So that is a great achievement at this point. But there's still a crucial year and a half left in this term where the ultimate impression of how this has been done will still be determined.
One of the talking points now for roughly 2 years that Senate Majority Schumer has taken pride in, that the White House has taken pride in, is that they've exceeded Trump's pace in confirmations, that they have confirmed more judges at a specific time in Biden's tenure than Trump had. That has been repeatedly emphasized. That's no longer true, is it?
No, and that's unfortunate. I mean, the proof will be in the pudding. What is the status of this at the end of 4 years? If there is a lull right now, which there is, unfortunately, that's not a good thing. But the test should be ultimately what is done within 4 years. However, yes, not only our organization, but many others and the White House and the Senate have been bragging about the fact that Trump had fewer confirmations until now. At the end of July, it now stands that Biden has confirmed 140, but at that point, Trump had confirmed 144. And why did this happen? It's because things really slowed down earlier this year. There were no confirmations at all in the Senate in January. Part of this had to do with Senator Feinstein and her illness, but it goes back farther. We urged the Democrats in the Senate and anybody else in the Senate who wanted to help out on this to really make use of last year's lame duck period, to stay in November and December and do more of this. And it really wasn't done. And so a lot of those judges were still on the table and had to still be confirmed. And some of that happened recently, but there also was a failure now to take advantage of the August recess that is currently underway. When McConnell and Trump were calling the shots, they stayed in and they confirmed all kinds of people in May, June, and July just before, and even stayed in for an August recess one time. And as a result, they not only obviously are ahead right now, but there's going to be a real challenge to make sure that they end up ending up ahead of Trump. And, you know, it's largely symbolic. It isn't like, okay, something's going to change significantly, whether there's one more or two more than Trump. But it's a symbol of the commitment of the administration and the Senate to taking away the dominance of the right and ideologues from the courts. That's why it's important. That's the courts matter aspect of this. It's not just numbers.
Well, and in terms of diversifying the federal court, because of the size of the federal court, right, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of federal judges, numbers matter. It's not enough to have 140 diverse judges. You need many, many, many more diverse judges if you're actually going to achieve a judiciary that reflects the diversity of the public it serves. And I appreciate you going back to last year's lame duck, because we spent a lot of time saying that the Senate should confirm at least 25 judges during the lame duck. They only confirmed 13. They didn't confirm a single judge in the month of January. They didn't confirm a single judge in the month of April. And as you noted, there were some attendance issues for valid medical reasons for a chunk of spring. But even June and July, we saw single-digit confirmations. It just suggests that judges have been put on a back burner over the last half year.
I mean, I don't know if that's really the attitude. I don't think it's the attitude. It's the reality of the slowing down.
Yeah.
Part of it is that there aren't enough appointments coming from the White House. You need to actually have people appointed.
Although there's 17 nominees pending on the Senate floor right now.
Right. And of course, they showed recently, it was sort of frustrating how fast they could move when they wanted to. They got rid of, there was like twice as many of those, and they were able to do it. But once these get done, it has to be the case that the Judiciary Committee has received and approved enough to help make up the difference. The challenge here is to get pace with Trump again, is to get 47 more confirmations between now and the end of this year, 187.
Which really means between September and the end of the year, right, since they're taking August off. So that's 47 confirmations that they need in 4 months.
Yeah, and that means longer weeks of work. That means staying in November and December to get this done. It means getting rid of the blue slips, which are the things in the Judiciary Committee and states with Republican senators that block district court nominees who clearly should be the choice of President Biden. The reality is This slowdown is in part because, understandably, the administration and the Senate went for the low-hanging fruit, meaning those vacancies that were in states with two Democratic senators. The pool isn't the same now, but that doesn't mean you don't dig in and stay in longer to get through the procedural barriers, but that means getting rid of the blue slips and it means staying in session. We at ACS call this expand the calendar. Don't assume that you have to follow the same calendar that's always followed. McConnell and Trump didn't do it. They said, look, we got to get this done. And clearly the courts of this country are so important that this administration and this Senate needs to act aggressively between now and the end of this year.
Well, and in expanding the calendar, I would say there's two notes. One is, as you've repeatedly pointed out, the Senate majority controls the calendar, right? Schumer gets to decide when the Senate is in session and when it's not. And I think we have all remembered those moments where the Senate is still in session at midnight, at 1 a.m., at 2 a.m., because they're trying to avoid a shutdown. There's discussion of a debt ceiling, right? Like, there are moments we all remember. The Senate can work very long hours when they want to.
Yeah, and of course, it doesn't even always involve that. It just involves being around on a Friday, being around on a Saturday. It doesn't have to be, you know, cruel, but it does involve, look, saying, look, guys, yeah, cancel your vacation plans, cancel your political plans. We got to get this done. And, you know, if anybody really believes that running around their state campaigning is what determines elections anymore, I wish it was, but it's not reality. You know, the reality is that so much goes on with social media and money and campaigning of on the media, that the idea that somehow sticking around for a few more days in Washington is going to determine whether you win or lose, it's not really true anymore. So they should stay there and get this done. It will help motivate the base of people all over this country who see their rights being attacked by courts that are dominated or increasingly dominated under Trump and McConnell by hard right ideologues. This people care about. And that's more valuable than, you know, going to another chicken dinner.
Yeah, I think two of the issues that have really proven to motivate voters in the last couple of years are abortion and the preservation of our democracy. Two issues on which I think it is fair to say that courts have a greater impact on right now than Congress does. Right? The fate of abortion rights right now is increasingly being handled by the judiciary, and our elections are increasingly litigious affairs. It's issues that judges have so much impact on. And so in terms of a senator's ability to campaign on those two issues, being able to point to the number of judges that they've confirmed has got to be a pretty top of the page talking point.
That's right. And you know what, it's having a huge impact on Democratic elections right now for the Democratic Party. I was just out in California, and all the major candidates for Feinstein's seat have now endorsed adding seats to the United States Supreme Court because of the concern about the court being locked down by the right into the next 20, 25 years. That is politics. That is a sign that people are very motivated by this. And I think you'll find that this is going to be an historic election. There have been a few others, but one of the most famous elections will be coming up about how people feel about the courts. I think it had a huge impact in 2022. I think it'll have a huge impact in 2024. And for the first time, it's really having an impact that has been beneficial to the more progressive side. In the past, the courts matter mantras worked with the right. But now it is very, very of great concern to the left and to those in the middle because they are seeing their rights taken away by a rogue United States Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is going to be the second presidential election cycle where Republican candidates think it is to their advantage to announce a list of potential Supreme Court nominees. That would never have been done before, but now it's standard practice. Here are the really arch conservative folks I would put on the court. And on the progressive side, it's about reform. It's about countering that threat of the right packing the court even more than it already is.
Yeah, I'm hoping this doesn't become standard practice. One of my concerns is that some Democrats will decide to do this kind of list too, because, you know, if you're trying to differentiate yourself in a campaign, they may try to do that. Of course, there will be some opposition to President Biden, probably not a great deal. But yes, this should not become standard practice, especially because the right essentially handed over the constitutional right of the president to nominate and the Senate to confirm to the Federalist Society, who became a gatekeeper and recommender of all these people. And, you know, we at the American Constitution Society are second to none in terms of recommending excellent candidates for the federal courts. We do this better than anybody and nationally, but we don't have an attitude that anybody else is out. We think that's wrong. We think that's inappropriate to have a private group be a gatekeeper.
We don't dictate nominations by any means. We
absolutely
recommend.
Not. And we think it's wrong.
So just going back, so we're talking about judicial confirmations. Our goal is to have this administration match or ideally exceed Trump's pace to catch up basically by the end of this year. Trump had 187 judges confirmed in 3 years. That means this Senate confirming 47 more. The White House recently announced 4 more nominations. We hope to see more, but really this is about the Senate. The Senate has a bunch of candidates currently pending before it. It needs to take action. You mentioned blue slips. What are a couple other things that the Senate could do? You mentioned expanding the calendar. You've also talked about how the Senate could reform its rules right to expedite confirmations. Give me a couple ideas there.
This may have a little bit less impact than the blue slips, but you know, currently, even though you know the votes are already there, in other words, there's a majority for cloture on a particular judge on the floor, there's still this 30 hours of debate after a court of appeals judge, which is completely unnecessary because it's already decided. Everybody knows what's going to happen. It's just a delay tactic. So that would require a rule change, as has been done in the past. It's already been done with regard to district court nominees, where it was reduced from 30 hours to 2 hours. So this is very technical stuff. But here's the thing. When it comes to the Senate, time is money. In other words, the determinant is how much time there is, because there's only so many days in a week, only so many days that you can get people to be there. Having them able to waste 30 hours on something that's already decided makes no sense, and it would require a rule change and should be done.
It's kind of like expand the calendar, right? You either expand the calendar to create more time, or you reduce the amount of time that it takes to confirm a judge. Right. Both of those are about manufacturing more time.
Right. Now, there's a whole bunch of ways you can expand the calendar. You can do it through using lame duck sessions. You can do it by using recesses. You can do it by, as you said, there later at night. And by the way, we should signal right now as an organization to the administration and to the Senate that we consider the election year to be a time to confirm judges as well. Trump only confirmed, let's see, it looks like 47 judges in the entire election year. I don't think the attitude should be, oh, it's election year, we can't do this. This should be very strongly pushed as a sign of good government, of trying to take back the courts. It can be a positive message in an election year that people are staying there to get this done. And I think that we should be looking forward to expanding the calendar, not only this year, which is crucial, but also next year.
Yeah, and I think what we can end on is we know this is possible. The Senate has confirmed as many as 12 judges in a week. When they really want to, when they put their foot on the gas pedal, they can go through quite a number of nominations. And so getting through 47 in 4 months is a challenge. We are very mindful of that, but it is an achievable challenge.
Yeah, I'm going to conclude on a positive note. Not only is it possible, I bet they'll do it.
I love that.
I know these folks. I think they know that this is really not going to look good if they're behind Trump at the end of 4 years. I think they're going to get it done, but it's what you just said. It's like you can really do a lot if you put your mind to it. And our role is to encourage that and to make sure that people realize how important this is to people across the country and to everybody who's concerned about their rights. This needs to be done by this administration. So far, it's one of the greatest achievements they've had, and it needs to get even better.
Yeah, and for listeners who care about this, we would just say what we say so often, which is talk about the courts. Talk about judges. Make sure that your friends think it's important when you're talking to candidates. Make sure that judges are at the top of the list for items that you care about. As we talked about earlier, when courts become electorally relevant, that's when elected officials really start paying attention.
That's absolutely right. And that's the recent history when we saw the big election in Wisconsin for the state Supreme Court, where somebody won by 200,000 votes, which is almost unheard of in Wisconsin in a Supreme Court race. It was without a doubt, the attack on reproductive rights that made the difference.
Russ, thank you so much for returning to Broken Law. It is always a treat to chat with you.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Lindsay and Russ for joining me on Broken Law. Summer is a great time to catch up on all your missed episodes of Broken Law, so take a minute to browse our complete episode library wherever you are listening to this episode. And make sure to follow us on social media at ACS Law on Twitter, at American Constitution Society on Instagram, and using hashtag Broken Law Podcast. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.